Hello, everyone, and welcome to the Jus Comune podcast. My name is Emilia Mataix Ferrandi from the International University of Catalonia in Barcelona. And today I am very happy to have two very special guests. First, Professor Jakob Gildijs, Associate Professor at the Department of Jurisprudence of the Faculty of Law at the University of Amsterdam and PI of the project Servus, the Reception of Roman Law Outside Europe. And also together, we have Dr. Christine Mertens, who will soon defend her PhD at Leiden University, and is a postdoc at the Servus project as well in the Department of Jurisprudence, the Faculty of Law and University of Amsterdam. Welcome, and thank you very much for being here. So to start, to introduce our listeners, can you provide an overview of the historical and legal context of the period that you're studying to help, you know, situate the conversations?
Yes. So this project really covers a fascinating and complex period of legal history, I would say, beginning in the 15th century with the colonization of the Americas after 1492 and continuing through the period of European colonial expansion and transatlantic slavery up to the abolition of slavery and era of codification in the 19th century. And even though this is quite a large periodization, I would say the core chronological focus of the project lies in the 17th and 18th centuries, which is a period when European colonial empires consolidated their power and established systems of unfree labor. And during these centuries, slavery is introduced in these colonies and a legal framework of slavery with an extensive set of laws regulating the enslaved, but also indigenous peoples and other forms of labor, such as indentured servitude, emerge.
So. We are focusing on three territories in particular. Obviously, it would not be manageable to focus on the whole of the world or even large parts of the world. I think our focus is primarily on the U.S., the now U.S. state of Virginia, as a common law English colony, the territories of Curaçao and Suriname, which are erstwhile Dutch colonies, and the current country of Chile, which was at least a part of the Spanish colonial project.
Thank you very much. And then, so how did Roman legal texts survive into the early modern world and why they become so important outside Europe?
Yes. Yeah. This is a bizarre process that I think we're teaching that to our law students in Holland. It will be taught certainly in other countries in Europe as well. It's the weird historical accident of the legislation of the Emperor Justinian, which is a compilation of earlier texts, surviving into the Middle Ages and being restudied at the first universities, linking to the authority of the Holy Roman Empire and to the Holy Roman Emperor in particular. And from the renewed study of these texts comes the idea that at one point or another, Roman law gets reapplied into a large variety of concrete legal context all over Western Europe, leading to Roman law, eventually also coupled with canon law and feudal law as a type of Western European universal law, a jus commune, as it is at one point termed. So this is the so-called process of reception in Western Europe. I think already from the 15th century onwards, and I would refer particularly to the Spanish late scholastics here, Roman law, either in its guise as, you know, the Justinianic legislation or in its so-called received form, in its jus communis form, was seen as particularly relevant for colonial relations, either between colonial powers and local populations or as a mode of rule in the colonies themselves. The reason for this is somewhat unclear, but we see it basically not only in the Spanish colonies, where the Siete Partidas, so Spanish, the Castilian version, royal version of Roman law, was applied in the Spanish colonies. We see it in the Dutch context, which we will likely talk about in a minute. But also there, we see that particularly the Roman Dutch version or the jus commune version of Roman law was applied in the colonies, and we even may see it in the surprisingly perhaps in the English colonies. There's this idea that Roman law was never applied or at least received in this English context. Well, we might make a case that this maybe may pertain to England itself, but that the colonies were a different situation altogether, that there actually is a big influence of Roman law in whichever guise in those colonies.
And so do you think that the Servus project will help to rethink about this history of reception in the traditional European sense, despite the fact that, as you said, everything starts with Justinian in the end?
Yes. Yeah, I refer directly to, so if you look at legal history in particular, it is still the work of Alan Watson that I think is paramount. So slave law in the Americas. The title also shows the particular context in which his book is written. And in that work, Watson argues quite vehemently that something like a reception of Roman law did not take place in the colonies. And with reception, Watson obviously is a major expert on the notion of reception as such, of Roman law, but of reception as such. With reception, Watson means this scientific study of the texts leading to concept shaping. I would agree with Watson that what happens in the colonies is not the hardcore scientific study of particularly private law dogmatics. There is no need in the colonies to do that. Therefore, it does not happen. But I don't think that means that Roman law was not applied, maybe even akin to a type of concept shaping as had happened in Europe prior.
Thank you. So why does it looking at slavery and the concept of servus, why this concept of servus, why did you choose it? But I understand that it can reveal something quite deep about the global history of law and even about also economic history as well.
The notion of servus is interesting. So servus in Roman law, classical Roman law, Justinianic Roman law, just means slave. This is quite a clear-cut legal category. However, if you start looking at the process of reception of these texts from the Middle Ages onwards, in the Middle Ages, this is debated and this can be debated, there's not really such a thing as a slave in Western Europe at this time. So these texts, however, containing the term servus, are still being studied and applied in legal practice, which means a conceptual change takes place whereby a new meaning is given to that term servus. And I would, for the late Middle Ages, especially use the term serf, so vassal, so in the feudal context, right? But there is a variety of conceptual changes that takes place with respect to that term. And this goes, I think, all the way to the early modern era, probably even towards the age of codifications in Western Europe. In the colonies, however, there obviously is such a thing as slaves. So again, following Watson, who is studying only the Roman legal texts that contain the term servus, and he applies them only to the categories of slaves. Following the European development, I don't think that's all that happens. I think that there are texts that contain the term servus that are applied to other categories of people in the colonies, clearly in the Spanish and the Dutch colonies in any case, and that there are Roman legal texts that are not relevant to slave law per se, that do not contain the term servus, but that are applied to the slaves in the colonial context. So in two ways, this application of texts when reasoning from the usage of the term servus is broader than what Watson suggests. And this is what we are adding with our project to the current state of affairs.
Yeah, and if I may add, I think coming back to the question, what does looking at slavery in the concept of servus reveal and more about the global history of law? For one, I would say that this perspective also challenges this dominant view that common law and continental systems were such separate worlds, right? Our project is by no means a comparative history, but we do find striking similarities, such as Roman law-inspired public order provisions in both the Dutch and English Americas, which were adapted to local realities, but seem to have this similar Roman law origin. And vice versa, I would say, that is the global perspective, also allows us to shift the focus away from these national narratives. So histories of slavery and abolition are often framed as national stories, yet these cannot be fully understood without considering the transnational legal frameworks that shape them.
Thank you very much, Christine. Actually, I wanted to ask, because I know both of you have kind of divided territories, correct me if I'm wrong, I know that you work more with the Americas and Jacob works more with Curaçao and the Dutch colonies in that sense. So when you look, for example, at Servus and this concept of transformations of the term, as a matter of understanding legal history, histories of power, hierarchy, and legal status, do you find any commonalities, or is more like case-by-case status? And if these commonalities can be linked to the Roman law or the Roman law basis of this term that they are using?
Yes, yes. And make no mistake, colonial rule, by its very nature, is incredibly ad hoc. It's very haphazard. People have to respond. There's, you know, in as much as there is a legal structure in Europe or emanating from Europe, these local sort of governors, these local administrators, they have to quickly respond to usually very serious problems and situations that arise. I mean, from large-scale wars to smaller conflicts, as, for example, Lauren Benton in her new book sets out. And so the reaction of these tends to also be quite haphazard. This makes it all the more notable that when you start looking at the legal regulations and the court cases that are appended to these, that are the application of these legal regulations, that there are striking similarities between the colonies. And this is I think, very crucial in the sense that it shows that for some reason, Roman law was viewed as a law that was very useful and applicable to a colonial situation as such, going beyond, as Christina rightly says, these national narratives. And I think there's a point to that, because I think Roman law by its nature, by its character, is very useful for including and excluding people from different status and people in different situations. It does not pertain to, you know, Roman citizens alone. Slaves, foreigners, people with lower class status, people with higher class status are mentioned as separate legal categories in Roman law as such. And I think that made it particularly applicable to colonial situations, and it was seen as such. It was very much theorized as being the law for the colonies.
Yeah, maybe you're setting the stepping stone for a new field, the global colonial history, and it will be fed by Romanists. Then we'll be all very happy with that.
Yeah. No, but we're very much linking to the projects of Heikki Pihlajamäki in Helsinki and to Thomas Duva's work in Frankfurt, who've been studying global legal history and global law for some time now. It's our focus on Roman law that's relatively new in those two contexts.
Yeah. And I want to ask a very, very simplistic question, but maybe some of the listeners can be asking themselves that. So you talk about colonies, but then there's also the term empire that appears here and forth. Can we distinguish politically, you know, how law is applied depending if the, you know, for example, we have the Spanish Empire or you have the Dutch colonies. So yeah. Is there a difference there if you have been studying all these examples?
With respect to the Dutch colonial enterprise has been termed an empire in the literature as well. Mm-hmm. It's usually, however, seen as, I think the term is by Fitzmaurice, is an informal empire, because it's not based on colonial taking of land or ruling over land as if it were the territory of that colonial empire, but based on trading posts and having local influence or relations with local rulers by means of which the territory is actually administered. This changes, I think, in the late 18th century. The Dutch do become, colonial enterprise becomes a state affair. The West India Company, for example, goes bankrupt, and then the territories move towards the Dutch national state. And in that sense, they do actually become a regular empire. And also with respect to the usage of Roman law, I think empire is still the basic useful structures, the historical model by means of which these colonial enterprises were ruled. So I would, you know, go fully fledged on the term empire for the Spanish, Dutch, and the English enterprises.
Thank you. Yeah, and since you have already been looking to some archives, I know especially Christine has been traveling back and forth to the States as well. Would you mind giving us an example of a case study to, you know, to give a bit more of an idea to the listeners about how Roman legal ideas can be stretched or twisted to, you know, fit realities of oppression or even of protection as well?
Maybe I can take this question. So one striking example comes from Virginia in the 1660s. So one of the most important legal developments in the colony's history of slavery was the move to make slavery permanent and hereditary. So in 1662, Virginia reversed a very important presumption of common law by declaring that thereafter all children were to be considered free or enslaved according to the condition of the mother rather than that of the father, which was dominant in common law. And although this statute didn't cite Roman law explicitly, Virginians and others later linked it to the Roman law principle of partus sequitur ventrem, meaning that the offspring follows the womb. And this legal twist ensured that children of enslaved women would also be enslaved, laying effectively the foundation for racialized hereditary slavery in Anglo-American jurisdictions, because it was first adopted in Virginia, but later spread throughout the other American colonies. And interestingly, this same principle was also used by enslaved people as a tool of resistance and emancipation. So particularly in the late 18th century, I have encountered in the archives various freedom suits where in which enslaved people invoked partus to claim liberty for children born to free mothers, whether they were free white women or indigenous women. So this concept that was used to entrench slavery, which originated in Roman law, was also used to challenge it in a way.
Wow, that is very interesting. Thank you very much. And now I would like to move to a big guy that is kind of an elephant in the room here. So we need to talk about Grotius, of course. So Grotius, the Dutch humanist, how did he connect war, slavery, and sovereignty? And why did this fit so easily into Dutch imperial thinking?
Yes. So before addressing this question, I do have to point out that we are three, you know, white people talking about colonialism. This is not a good thing, but I think we will manage this. Grotius, if as a theorist of empire, the connection between war, sovereignty, and slavery is to an extent already made by Grotius's predecessors, especially the Spanish late scholastics. However, Grotius really explicitly introduces slavery as a separate category into that theory. And you can particularly see that connection in context in On the Laws of War and Peace, where he also specifically seems to talk about modes of colonial rule. That Grotius was a theorist of empire, I think can be referred to the work of Martina van Ittersum, who states that Grotius, up until a late age, attempted to create or construct or argue for a unified colonial structure. So in the Dutch context, meaning one that was valid for both the East India Company as well as the West India Company. On this basis, van Ittersum already suggests that large parts of On the Laws of War and Peace need to be read in the context of that colonial enterprise, even parts that are not overtly about colonialism as such. Much like Vittoria, Grotius gives a sovereignty, equal sovereignty, for example, to indigenous peoples, within the Dutch colonial context. However, he also creates the theory by means of which that sovereignty can be made relative, can be even be taken away, particularly via notions such as monopoly contracts and notions such as unequal treaties. And if these contracts or treaties are violated, then the Dutch Empire, following Grotius's theory, is at rights to take the land away from the indigenous peoples or punish them in other ways. With respect to the term servus, I think what Grotius really introduces there, also the idea that servus does not always need to mean slave. If I look at the term servus as it is used in Grotius, I think it pertains to slaves, but I would say it generally means people in the colonies. This sounds rather counterintuitive because it's such a clear-cut, overtly clear-cut legal category. Grotius is a theorist of empire, I would say, in the sense that he really attempts to, for the first time, formulate a type of colonial rule. And this is something the late scholastics did not do. This is something that Grotius really adds to the mix.
Yeah, but as a theorist of empire, I mean, I think Grotius has a tendency of cherry picking whatever he wants to create his blueprint, right? In what ways do you think he cherry picks what he picks from Romolo and what he leaves out because maybe it's not useful or interesting for him?
Yes, I think for the European context, it's quite clear that I think cherry picking is a very tempting way to put it, but I don't think it really accurately describes what Grotius does. So with respect to Roman law in general, Grotius is notorious for, putting this, for taking up Roman law as a rational law. It is, as he says in the inleiding, a wijsheids- en billigheidsvol, and as such is applied in the Dutch and Western European contexts. However, for colonial rule, that sort of barrier of, for example, local customary law or local statutes is not even there. I think Roman law for Grotius really is the law par excellence to be applied in the colonies. And we can see that. He does not only apply Roman law, he even explicitly uses the Roman imperial model as something that the Dutch need to strive towards applying in their colonial enterprise. He sees Roman law as an essential part of the Roman of Roman imperialism, and that is the law that he applies in the colonies. It is also, I mean, it is cherry picked, but it's also, I think there's a thought behind it. I think there's a thought behind the idea that, you know, you can use Roman law to regulate relations in the colonies, and that is something that he actually takes from, I think, the Roman imperial context itself.
So how do you think your project then, because we have been using this term, like theorist of empire, actually, but do you really think that the project is depicting him as more like this theorist of empire that is a bit more global, or more like a person who, you know, like he created this kind of grammar of colonial domination to be practically used, but he didn't have like an idea as a whole of like an empire or something like that?
Yeah, I think he did have an idea of empire. And I think this idea was also viewed as a very useful model, particularly in the English context. I would say that Grotius was widely read and widely viewed as someone who attempted not just, you have to understand that up until Grotius, theories of colonialism as related to Roman law particularly pertains to the acquisition of land, so to occupation and matters of manners of ways in which in Roman law unoccupied or occupied land could still be taken by another owner, in this case the colonial empire. For this there's the Benton and Straumann article on acquiring empire by law. But I think what Grotius does is really think one step beyond that and say, well, once we have this land, once we do have this establishment of informal empire, how do we then rule it? And I think that is the step that that Grotius makes, that makes him into, well, as you say, a theorist of empire. He's about the rule of the colonies, not so much about the taking of them.
Yeah, but this, sorry, you were going to say, Christine.
No, if I may add, I think what Jacob is saying is that you also see that in practice. So for instance, in these court cases later on, especially in the English colonies, where Grotius is cited both to defend slavery, but also to oppose it. So I think that really sort of underlines or underscores his role as more than, and really as his theorist of empire.
Yeah.
No, that is very good you mentioned that, because my next question was going to be like it. And then as a theorist of empire, he managed to get his idea around all the different cases that you're studying, even if they are far away and, you know, communications is not that easy or something. He managed to get all around.
Yeah. Well, we see him pop up in Virginia court cases. And
we know in your libraries in Virginia court cases. So.
Mm-hmm. Yes, which is strange, because this is a completely different jurisdiction than, I mean, if anything, the English were very hostile to Grotius's thoughts. I would just point to, you know, Selden, someone who argues directly against Grotius's on the Free Sea. But apparently he was, you know, seen as useful enough to be applied in this completely, in this context, as different as the local Virginia court cases.
Yeah, maybe they thought, okay, it's useful for slavery, so we're going to pick this guy, even if we hate him in the other side.
Yes.
That both is very ways. Tricky. So not only useful to sustain slavery, but also to resist it.
Yes.
Yeah, that is a very, very interesting point, actually. I mean, and I don't know what Grotius may think about that, you know, like if he wanted to have a purpose and then people is actually using it against his thought, so... That is actually very interesting.
Grotius is very ambivalent about slavery. We organized a conference about this in Amsterdam in 2024, of which various articles have been published in the journal Grotiana. The conceptualization, so not of the term servus, but of slavery in Grotius, is quite complicated. It's not a clear-cut theory at all. I would say, you know, this can be explained by the fact that it needed to be very much applicable in the colonial rule itself, right? And, you know, conceptual modeling is something that's actually quite useful in colonial rule.
Yeah, actually that is the way he could be more widespread. That is very smart, actually. So I would like to move a bit to one concrete case study, Curaçao, that you have been dealing with. So then we are talking about another big actor in this colonial enterprise, the West India Company. So how did the West India Company imagine the legal order of Curaçao, and where did Roman law enter in that design?
Yes, in a very convoluted way, I would say. The West India Company starts out as, you know, this informal empire where Curaçao is a trading post. Basically, it's a small island, and it's mainly used as a stop on the slave trading routes between Africa and the Latin American countries, i.e. the Spanish colonies. Curaçao even has, or the West India Company on Curaçao even has the monopoly on the asiento on the slavery, on the slave trade for quite a long time, up until 1730. So the Roman law was generally seen as applicable in all of the Dutch colonies. We know this because in 1629, there is a so-called Ordre van de Regeringen, a government order, which apparently pertained primarily to the north of Brazil. That basically gives the regulations for how to rule a colony. And in the subsequent instructions, so instructions to particular governors, Roman law is mentioned as gemene rechten or jus commune, as one of the legal sources a governor needs to use to rule his colony. These regulations pertain to northern Brazil, but are generally seen as also pertaining to the island of Curaçao. Roman law we only really see applied on Curaçao after 1730. So after the Dutch, the West India Company, lose the monopoly on the slave trade with Spain, I would say, but this is a conjecture, that at this point, slaves are not being transported down to the Latin American colonies anymore, but they stay on the island. So Curaçao becomes this plantation slave economy. In that context, you suddenly need to manage the enslaved population, and therefore you need to apply Roman law in practice. So Roman law theoretically was applied for over 100 years on Curaçao, but before it actually became to be applied in practice.
And now because we're talking a lot about how, you know, it was like more generally used, but I wonder actually, how did in practice, you know, principles such as Monkey Patio, how the liberation of slaves, how this, you know, this dealing when you liberate a slave and you have this duty towards your previous dominus, does this persist in all these colonial cases, or this disappears?
Yes, yeah, we see this duty even in Suriname, even up until the 19th century, in legal regulations. I have to say that with respect to manumission and to runaway slaves, these are categories that very clearly in the Dutch context, Roman law is used quite broadly. But this is also because those categories, those legal notions can only really be applied to slaves, right?
Mm-hmm.
So the application is cherry-picked and haphazard, but I think to an extent quite clear. I think the same may actually go for Virginia as well. I think things really get interesting when we're talking about legal notions that are not clearly applicable to slaves in Roman law, but are still being applied in the colonial context via this term servus.
Yeah, but when they apply the category of servus, I mean, something I normally explain to the students is like what, for example, differs of the conception of a slave in Roman law is that for them is more an idea of like bad luck, to say it in a way. You're conquered and then you become a slave, right? It's not about you being, you know, from a specific race or something. That does persist or changes, because we know that in the States at some point it becomes reduced to a category of a certain kind of race of people. So I don't know if with this colonial movement, this principle changes into being, you know, portrayed as some kind of a specific race or you know, group of people.
Yeah, it clearly, and again, I would also probably speak for Virginia here, in the course of the 18th century, it clearly gets racialized. At one point, it is, I mean, the term slave and the term black person, the term enslaved and the term black person are seen as interchangeable. I think at first, it's primarily non-Christian. I think the religious dimension at first, so in the courses of the 16th and 17th century, it's the non-Christian character of the person in question that is crucial. But it gets racialized, yes, especially in the course of the 18th century.
Yeah, and one of the moves that is important in that regard is, for instance, that principle of partus that we talked about earlier, because it was specifically passed at first because there were a lot of mixed race children being born. So this principle also sort of establishing or using this principle sort of also fixed that issue, that you don't have these mixed race children who are of a contested legal status.
Okay. And also, some people that we have not yet talked about is like, for example, in the case of Curaçao, you deal with some prosecutors actually that are big enablers of this sort of like theory of slavery that they want to, you know, use in the colonies, etc. So these are, I'm butchering their names, because as Van Schagen and Corman. So these ones are two big characters on like putting kind of some order in the chaotic rule and the use of Roman law in the colonies. Can you explain a little bit more about them? And do we have parallels of in other colonial contexts, like prosecutors or people who are the enforcers of this sort of like theories of slavery?
Yes, absolutely. So conjecturally, again, we see Jan van Schagen, who is a so-called fiscaal, which can be translated as a public prosecutor, someone who is responsible for, you know, public order, for punishing criminals on the island of Curaçao. We see him propping up in the sources right after losing the monopoly on this, the WEC losing the monopoly on the slave trade. I don't think this is a coincidence. Again, then the missing link would be that a lot of the slaves started to remain on the island. Therefore, there are these problems of public order. And I think Van Schagen and his successor Koermans are very interesting because they apparently they have a level, maybe even quite a high level of legal scientific knowledge that they bring from the metropole. And in that, it appears, particularly in the case of Koermans, that their expectation of what colonial law looks like clashes with what actually happens in practice. And Koermans, in particular, is very critical of this. He's expecting what, you know, what Watson is also expecting, namely this legal scientific application of Roman law with, you know, fully fledged legal notions such as contract and delict. And this just does not happen. And he is critical of that. And he informs the chamber of the West India Company in the metropole of this. And they are very lackluster about this. They say, well, you cannot expect this, right? This turns into a fully fledged conflict. I would also refer to the great book of Bastiaan van der Velde, I would say the legal historian of the island of Curaçao. The title of this work of the legal history of Curaçao is called Ik lach met Grotius en al die prullen van boeken. I laugh at Grotius and all these trash books, right? This is something a local governor says. Huh? So clearly there is this disconnect between what the metropole may expect or what the colonial structure may expect and what happens in actual practice, right? Colonial rule, in essence, remains haphazard, despite the incidental application of Roman law in several contexts.
But that could not be considered abuse, the fact that, you know, you have like a theory of empire, or whatever you want to call it that way, and then people in their areas are basically doing whatever they want because they're, you know, like considering this is more the way of acting.
Yeah.
Yes, and I think we also must consider the interest at stakes here, because we see in the English colonies, a similar kind of contest of power emerge, for instance, about the punishments of slaves, whether masters can kill enslaved people without impunity, and the crown actually tries to influence this situation, but that's often kind of difficult because you have these enslavers who have a stake in slavery and who actually are the ones who are passing and making the laws.
Yes. Okay. I think this is very interesting, this clash, which I find to be present very much in the treatment of the sources by the historians and not so much by the legal historians as of yet, this clash between local colonial administration and, for example, slaveholders. I think in traditional literature, we often assume that the interests of the slaveholders and the colonial administration, particularly with respect to, you know, managing the enslaved population, that they align. I find that when I look at the sources, that it rarely is the case, that there are often clashes. And I think in these clashes, Roman law plays a particular but very understudied role.
Yeah, no, that's very interesting, because also then you're linking to this field of law in the books and law in action that is actually very, very trendy now and very interesting. So to be a bit more general and kind of concluding, because I've used a lot of your time, so do you think that this project is the start of something? Do you think that you can make kind of like maybe it's like a bit of a far-fetched term, but scalable model? Like you are using conceptual history and then maybe can be translated to other colonial contexts and even another historical period. You mentioned also, for example, the case of Heikki Pilajamäki, who is studying more Latin America. So can you, you know, like can they make use of some of the theories you are getting here?
I think you rightly point out this difference between law in the books and law in action. And I think colonial lawmaking may be one of the best examples, or at least historical examples we have, of conceptual legal legal concept shaping in a situation where there are written legal regulations, but those are quite broad and usually also very haphazard and very casuistic. So in these colonies, we can actually see this legal concept shaping in a very direct way, and very importantly, I would also say in a way that comes back to Europe. I think this is also quite understudied. I would refer to work on, for example, the late scholastic Vittoria, whose theories are developed in a colonial context, also referencing Roman law, but are enormously influential back in Europe. The same goes for John Locke, who writes the Constitution of North Carolina some years before he writes two treatises on government. And these are theoretical examples, but I think if we're talking about, you know, broader versions of this project, it is actually about how colonial legal concept shaping comes back to Europe and becomes incredibly important there.
So the problem then will be, okay, the concept part, it's okay, but then the problem will be then the law in action part, because then obviously it's casuistic, right? It really depends, because even sometimes, as you were saying, the prosecutors, they don't really abide with the concepts as well, right? They do whatever they think.
Yeah, no, but there are still fundamental, weird, I mean, possibly coincidental similarities between these various imperial or national contexts. I think these are notable. I cannot explain them, right? But I still think the idea that the similarities are there is an indication that at some point, particularly these legal notions were seen as incredibly useful in a context of colonial rule at first, and possibly in a theoretical sense later.
So where this research might lead next? What are the next steps of the Cerebus project? I know you have a website in construction, and I don't know what other things can we expect of the Cerebus project in the future.
I'm looking at Christine.
Oh. <That's it>. Sorry.
Christine, what will you do next?
Well, I think we're very much now in the middle of the project. Jakob and I are writing, and I think, and what would be an excellent paper on public order provisions, in comparing, well, not really comparing, but seeing the same origin in Roman law in the English and in the Dutch colonies. But I think the next step would also to focus on Chile and the era of codification. And I think you can tell much more about that, Jakob.
Yes, absolutely. Now we are, I think the next step will be is to look at actually quite a later period. So the era of codification, particularly the 19th century codifications of the Latin American countries, and even more particularly the codification of the country of Chile, which happens in 1857. The person behind this codification is actually a famous law scholar called Andrés Bello, who hails from Venezuela, but was responsible for creating the Chilean civil code, which I think is a masterpiece. And Andrés Bello is in the run-up to creating this code. He is in Europe a lot, taking in contemporary ideas on how to codify law, and also how to use jus commune and Roman law notions in codifying law. I'm here explicitly referring to Friedrich Karl von Savigny, and I think it's the next step would be is to see, well, knowing that Andrés Bello is also an expert on Roman law, he writes an introduction to Roman law, how he deals with this Roman law notion of servus as it had been applied in the Spanish colonies and in Chile in particular before the independence of Chile, and how he deals with it after the independence of Chile and the creation of this codification. So it's quite a direct and concrete mode of conceptual change that we'll be looking at.
Yeah, maybe it would be nice to add that though our website is saying a lot of the sources that we are currently using for the project and finding from the archives, that would be very much interesting to any, I think, scholar of Jus Commune or law student, history students. So please keep a watch on that as well.
Yeah, definitely. Do you think that, for example, you will be able to digitalize, for example, some of the core documents that you're seeing in the archives, or that will not be allowed by the archives?
Well, we actually already have some sources that we are using, for instance, from Grotius, but from also legal treatises that we have been looking at.
Okay, great. Thank you so very much. Looking for forward to that. And then I would like to thank you very much for your time, and I wish you all the best for the following years of the Cervus project. Thanks again for being here today.
Thank you, Emilia.
Thank Lovely. You.
Yeah.